This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
I'm Jane Artes, and for my sins, I'm the Director of Research at the Higher Education Careers Services Unit, which we abbreviate to the acronym HECSU. And it's my great pleasure to come to talk to you today about some of research work that we've been doing, notably a project called Future Track. But just in case anybody is making their way from the coffee to here, I'll just draw your attention very quickly to one or two bits and pieces I've left on the table that might be useful. There's a little summary document of Future Track. There are also a couple of magazine-style information sheets called Graduate Market Trends, which are... which is basically a quarterly publication that my colleagues and I produce at HECSU, which just summarises the current state of research and development within the graduate labour market. You'll notice some of you might have a red one, some might have a blue one. The blue one is the new improved version, but actually the content's very similar. So do help yourself to those. But I'm thinking that we are all here now, so perhaps we'll make a start. I'm probably wiser to spend a little bit of my time close to the microphone, but at any time I become inaudible, do please wave your hand, as I have a slight cold this morning, just sort of getting over a summer cold. The organisation that I work for, HECSU, is in fact an educational charity, and you may well be familiar with our sister organisation, Graduate Prospects. More people, certainly people from the schools community and the universities who are dealing with the transition out of university into employment will probably have heard of Prospects. The bit that I work for is the educational charity, and we're responsible for the research and development work, in other words, creating a lot of the information and resource that Graduate Prospects use. I can explain a little bit more about that if anybody's interested to do so. And we are also a membership organisation, so if anybody would like to have more information about that during the course of the day, I'm here for most of the day, and so is a colleague of mine who will be able to give you more information about becoming a member of the organisation. But for this morning's presentation, I'd really like to focus upon telling you a little bit about our studies, Future Track and Future Track Part-Time, which are two very major longitudinal studies looking at student and graduate career development. And the hope, if we have time, is to look at this from the point of view of what we learn from these studies in terms of student anticipation of HE, how satisfied they are with it. We'll also have a little look at working, and particularly information that we have about why students work, how they're managing their mounting debts and so on, and also the impact of institutional type. Much mention was made this morning about the differences between institutions, and certainly we've been looking at that in our study too, and there are some very grave differences or quite marked differences. So what I propose to do is to take you through a presentation, but at any stage if you want to ask me a question or interrupt, please do so, but hopefully there will be some time for discussion at the end as well, but do stop me if you wish to have some more information as we go. First of all, what is Future Track? Very quickly and briefly, has anybody here heard of it? Yes? No? Nobody heard of it? Oh, good. Often nowadays, people have heard of it, so I can sort of gloss over this bit, but for you, I'll explain. It's actually a longitudinal tracking study, and we're tracking the career development of the 2006 cohort of entrants to HE. The emphasis on entrants is very deliberate. As you probably know, if you're working in, particularly in universities, a lot of the work that focuses around what happens to university graduates focuses on that period as they're leaving, graduating, moving into the labour market. We wanted to look at career development as people were beginning HE. And so we worked very closely with UCAS to actually mount a study which would invite applicants to HE to join in a four-stage study that was going to span 5 years. The first stage of of collecting data was actually as people were making their application in 2006. The second stage was about a year, 18 months later, after students had had quite a substantial period of experience of HE. The third stage was, in fact, in the summer of 2009, when, as you would very quickly guess, those who started on three-year courses in 2006 were actually approaching graduation. And the fourth stage is yet to happen. It will be in 2011, when we hope that the majority of our subjects are actually moving into the labour market, or perhaps have completed a year of postgrad study, or if they're on longer courses, will have completed their courses. And it's basically the case that it's a very large study, and we're able to capture a lot of very diverse information about our participants because of the capacity we had at the start with working with UCAS. We were able to merge a lot of socioeconomic data, which had benefits to us in terms of not needing to collect that data from respondents as they completed our questionnaires. But also, it means that we can, particularly at stage one, where the responses were the best part of 130,000 people strong, we're able to classify the results according to not only gender and institutional type and school attended and so on, but to look at ethnic minority groups and to look at particular age groups and particular subject disciplines in quite some detail. And although HEXO is the agency who invented the programme, if you like, but it's being carried out by the University of Warwick under the leadership of Professor Kate Purcell, if anyone has perhaps... No nods. Kate Purcell is working very closely with other colleagues at the Institute for Employment Research at Warwick on this study for us. Future Track part-time, however, we were very concerned that Future Track, by its very nature, because we worked with UCAS at the early stages, is a study effectively of full-time students. And we were concerned that we need to have a corresponding study looking at the career progression of part-time students. And we have, in fact, a sister study called Future Track Part-Time Students, very imaginative change of name, but basically this study is looking at the same sorts of issues, but not for the whole cohort. Instead, it's a sample study, and they're looking at part-time students who are doing BA, BSc degrees, higher nationals, and foundation degrees on a selected range of subjects. And unlike the full-time Future Track, we are not progressing, tracking through one single cohort. What we're doing is that we have a sample of people who are beginning their learning and another sample of people who are completing their learning. We felt this was the wisest thing to do methodologically because, as you probably know, part-time students can take 10 years to complete their degrees without, and so we thought that the likely logistical problems of actually doing a tracking study on part-timers were too much to contemplate. And this study is being conducted for us by the University of London at Birkbeck under the leadership of Professor Claire Callender. Maybe some of you might have heard of Claire. She's written a lot about student support and student fees. Okay. Interestingly, when things began in 2006, and Future Track part-time was slightly later than that, the prospects for students and graduates were great, absolutely fabulous. People were leaving universities, getting jobs. The trajectory for most subject areas was very positive. What we didn't know when we started it would be that we were actually going to be tracking students into probably the worst economic situation that anybody has seen for the last 20, 25 years. And it enables us to sort of look at what has happened to those students in enormous detail, where one couldn't have imagined being able to do this previously, and tracking also, hopefully, the impact of the recession on the lives and first destinations of these individuals. It is also, 2006, the first year of variable tuition fees. We did a sample pilot for Future Track in 2005, and we have continued to maintain contact with a smaller number of people from the 2005 cohort who of course entered university under a very different fee arrangement. And some of the documents that we could direct you to make some very interesting comments about the differences in understanding from 2005 entrance to 2006 entrance. But it was a great time to start. And stage one of Future Track actually looks at how people applied. I hope this is visible. Is this visible at the back? You okay with that? As I mentioned earlier, the large number of respondents that we had at stage one enables us to differentiate responses by, in this case, this is minority ethnic groupings, in quite a lot of fine detail. So we can see here, getting into HE via the accepted UCAS scheme varies quite dramatically on the basis of ethnic grouping. I don't know whether this sort of information would surprise you, but certainly the light blue line, the light sort of lilac line there, indicates that something like half of black African applicants were likely to get in through that route as compared to top 70-odd percent of white applicants. And the data does enable us to do this sort of thing. And if you have time, might I suggest that it would be, it makes a great read, the stage one report, particularly for people in your situation, because it enables us to see things in great detail. One of the things that we are very interested in doing is that we ask them at stage one, why are you going to university? And the kinds of things they say to us are basically to improve my career prospects and to get a better job. In fact, those two reasons are two out of the top three. Anybody guess what the third one is? Anybody make a suggestion what the third reason, top reason is for going to uni?
Because my parents
don't want to. Actually, that comes quite low down the list. You'd be surprised. Yeah, yeah. Sorry? That's bottom half, yeah. But yeah, it's in there, yeah.
Enjoy the subject.
Yes, that's right. The first reason is to get a better job. The second one to get a because I love the subject, and the third one is to increase my prospects generally. And so, from our reading of that data, it suggests to us that the career related reason is the predominant one, is the really powerful one. And because our organisation is concerned with providing information and advice to students and graduates, this is the area that we're mainly interested in anyway. And so we have lots of questions at stage one about what you expect it's going to be like, what kind of information you received before you applied, and so on. And this slide here suggests that respondents here feel that they did not get enough information on the lilac column is the relationship between courses and employment options. And the sort of more purpley, dark, reddy purpley colour is information about courses available. Now, I don't know whether you can read the scale that clearly, but the course information's hovering about a third. So in 2006, people were feeling they didn't have enough information about courses. But worse than that, more like 40 to 50% and more are suggesting that they didn't have enough information about employment options. This is employment options beyond HE. Now, you could perhaps say, I used to be a careers advisor, I know some of this too. You could perhaps say, well, when people are applying to university, do they really think about what's coming next in terms of employment? They've got this sort of generalised sense that HE is going to confer a better working life and a better job and so on. But do they really know what they want to do? Do you think they do? Mm-hmm. Yeah. We can differentiate between all of these things. And yes, you're right, there is a relationship between age and clarity of career planning. And there's a very, very strong correlation between, well, perhaps I shouldn't say a correlation statistically, it's not quite correct, an association between subjects studied and clarity of career plans. So, for example, the more obviously vocational courses like medicine and dentistry, yes, people say when we ask them to rate themselves on a scale from 1 to 7, they're up at the 1s. They're saying, yes, I'm clear, I know what I want to do. The philosophers and the historians are down towards the 6s and 7s, this is true, and you know, people fan out in between. And there does seem to be also some association between socioeconomic group and clarity of plans. But after a year, it actually alters. And we find that after a year, people, do you think they're less clear or more clear? So after a year or so at uni, that they're basically saying, we're less clear now. Even the medics and the dentists are less clear. And one assumes this is because they now know that there's more to life than being a doctor. Actually, you could be a paediatrician or a gynaecologist or work in a hospital or work in a practice and so on. And there's a beginning of a convergence, really, in terms of whether they're clear or not. But certainly, why I raise this business about clarity, and also now the next slide you're looking at now is a question which reports on their view of the availability of information about post-16 choices by school and also by gender here. And you can see here that the both for males and females, there is a view that there was not enough information coming through the state school system. This is less likely to be reported by people in the independent sector and even the single-sex schools, of whom there are actually very few nowadays, as you well know. You know, there are some real differences here. And I think that the one of the really interesting things that's beginning to sort of show some evidence here within Future Track is that this whole business of making decisions about which course to take is really not quite as simple as the sort of current policy rhetoric would have us believe. I don't know quite how you felt about some of the comments that were said this morning, but there's a very, very strong rational paradigm at work at the moment that suggests that if you actually provide people with enough information at the right points in their time, that they will be able to make a decision. Do you think that's right? Is it? If you provide them with good information early enough, at the right time, it leads to a strong decision. Is that right? I mean, if you consider, I would challenge it too, actually, because I think that if you consider some of the decision-making that one engages in as part of life, how many people here are married or in serious relationships? Most people, yeah, or maybe had a serious relationship. Did you do it rationally? Did you find out about whether that person was healthy, had blue eyes because yours are blue, went to the right university, is earning more than $100,000 a year? Yeah, did you? These sorts of informations are available about potential spouses, aren't partners, aren't they? Did we do this? Probably, yes, maybe. Does nobody want to admit to this? No? Okay. I didn't either. But equally, probably, there probably aren't anybody people in the room who also went on a Spanish holiday and after 48 hours of non-stop beaching parties, you know, decided this is the one. You know, there's a big difference between the sort of rational model at one end of the spectrum and the totally impulsive, you know, I haven't thought about this at all, but it sounds okay, view of decision-making. And I think I would really like to sort of very clearly challenge the notion that career decision-making and indeed deciding which course or institution you choose can be that rational either. I don't think it's a question of just information. It's a question of lots and lots of bits of information, lots and lots of constraints, lots and lots of thoughts, ambitions, aspirations, yes, but also the views of significant others, things like location, nebulous things like reputation of the institution, perhaps a sense of what the outcomes might be, but maybe not to any huge extent, particularly amongst young people. There's a lot of information here. And I feel that one of the great difficulties that we have at the moment in terms of policy in this whole area is that we think of decision-making as an event. And actually, we should perhaps be considering decision-making as a process. And I just sort of throw that one out and sort of leave that, because that came across to me very strongly this morning, that a lot of what we do is about giving people information, whereas we don't necessarily talk to them about what it is, the stage at which they're at along the process, the learning process of making decisions. And certainly some of the stuff that comes out of Future Track, you know, qualitative comments, would tend to suggest that too. However, moving on. What I'm not going to be able to do because of the amount of time is to show you the whole of the study. But stage one, as I say, is about collecting information about anticipation of HE. I'm also involved with the National Student Steering Survey too. I'm on the steering group. And it's interesting that quite a lot of what does come out of the NSS, and particularly in terms of the supplementary questions, has a lot of resonance with our phase one. So if you do get a chance to read it, then I hope you'll find it helpful. A year later, we find, though, that the students are growing generally in confidence. We ask them questions about how confident are you, not only at your subject, but about basic key skills, communicating, and so on. Most of them are pretty happy bunnies, actually. I mean, those of you who are in HE, you're doing a fine job. Most of them are telling us that they're happy, they're satisfied, they're having a good time. And as I say, we've got thousands of them saying this. Again, is this readable from the back? Can you see this okay? We asked them lots and lots of statement banks type questions. And this is just a summary of some of the responses to statements about the student learning experience. On the whole, the tuition and learning support I received on my course are excellent. People are saying, yes, it was excellent. They really did enjoy it. I was given good feedback. This is something that the NSS has really had trouble with over the years, and I think made quite a lot of progress on, actually. But the thing that the Times Higher Ed picked up, there's anyone here from the Times Higher, hardly anyone on the academic staff knew my name. This is the sort of story that makes lovely press coverage, doesn't it? And we were lucky enough to find that Future Track at Stage 2 was reported in the Times Higher, which was a good story and was really nice. The following week, Laurie Taylor lampooned this one by putting lots of silly pictures of students up on the University of Poppleton, trying to help academic staff identify their students. But interestingly, the degree to which students say this varies, again, hugely by subject. Which subjects do you think would be likely for the students to say that the academic staff don't know who I am?
Business.
Yeah, that's
large cohorts.
Quite high up, yeah. Yeah, business is quite high up the list, yeah. Interesting. Arts and sort of humanities, social sciences, are sort of midway, really. But did you mean art and design, or?
No, more generally,
the arts. So it's this sense of large lectures and not a lot of contact face to face with staff on their own. Yeah, maybe. Yeah, there's any other suggestions as to who would be most likely to say the staff did know my name then? Where would you expect that to be? Colleges.
No, psychology.
That's another midway one, actually. The answer to it actually is art and design. The art and design students felt that staff did know their name and did know who they were and what they were doing. And one wonders if that's a function of different class sizes, smaller class sizes, or perhaps the more kind of hands-on role that maybe art and design teachers have to have with students developing work, I don't know. But at the other end of the spectrum, the ones where they're least likely to know my name are in fact dentists and medics. Which is a little bit worrying, isn't it? Or maybe it's that this is where they learn to say next. It actually starts here, doesn't it? Maybe, I don't know. But they're happy. We also asked them questions at stage two about things like the amount of work I had to do was excessive and I was given good feedback. And again, I hope this is visible to you, but I think if the slides are made available, you might be able to look at this at your own leisure. Then basically, again, we have very, very different sorts of responses here. Different responses to the medics and the dentists are saying, yes, the amount of work I had to do is excessive, and the creative art and design people saying not, in the main. Interestingly, linguistics and classics, and subjects like physical science is good feedback, and the responses on feedback are more similar, aren't they, across all the different subjects? But you know, there's some quite fun stuff here, really. Looking at the part-time study for a moment, that was Future Track, the main study. But the part-time study, one of the reasons why we were interested in doing this, as I said earlier, was to try to even up the balance between the full and part-time. But also, I think, it was because there is a very strong sense around that people on part-time students are actually working already. And part of this study includes a survey of employers' views, and particularly employers' views of students who are actually undertaking part-time study, so not just random employers, but the employers of our students. And we get quite interesting bits of feedback here from students at different stages in their development. So, for example, the starters are expecting to improve, that study will improve their ability to do their job, and actually, rather reassuringly, completers, nearly the same number of them, are telling us that, well, yes, it actually did. You know, it has improved my ability to do my job, which is really good news to the employers, because that's the sort of thing they're looking for too. They're also, on part-time students, are also looking for more satisfaction from my work. And here, I think the aspiration perhaps is a little bit stronger than the experience of it. But interestingly, we're also finding that these people are reporting satisfaction in terms of things like improved relationships and changes in the type of work that they're doing and so on. And really not all that much interest in just doing a part-time award in order to increase pay. You know, so although it's related to employment and it's related to the jobs they're doing, it's not always about changing jobs. And one of the things that we thought we would find in looking at the part-time students would be that lots of employers would not know they were studying. Because, again, isn't there a bit of a myth around that people do study in their, it sort of privately, because actually what they're trying to do is to dig their escape tunnel? The students in our study weren't saying that at all. In fact, something like 90-odd percent of them said their employers did know, and what was more, supported them. In fact, the whole business of balancing working and studying seemed to be something that came out of both studies very, very strongly, and particularly the need to manage debt and manage, in the case of the full-time students, to manage the anticipation of debt. This is a slide which, again, is taken from Future Track, the full-time study. We asked students after a year, 18 months, are you worried about the prospect of having to repay your loans and your debts? And there's some interesting differences here, aren't there, by minority grouping. It would appear on the face of it that people from the Asian Bangladeshi community are more worried about repaying debts and loans than people from the white communities. Now, again, you might say, well, perhaps this isn't surprising, maybe you know, you've come across this kind of statistic before. But when we flip this slightly and actually ask the same question, but we consider it from socioeconomic grouping rather than minority grouping participation, then we find that actually the ones who are more worried about debt are the ones from widening participation backgrounds. But not hugely so, really. We were surprised when we saw this. We thought that people from routine and manual occupation backgrounds, and we have lots of other questions in the survey as well that enable us to build a picture of socioeconomic status, really, including parental experience of HE and so on. But certainly on this was a bit surprising. We thought it would be bigger. Did you? No? Is it surprising? But then again, we have to remind ourselves that actually the people in Future Track are the ones who've decided to go into HE, haven't we? What Future Track sadly isn't, is a study of the people who decided not to go. And one wonders if you could have asked the same question of all of these, of everybody who thought about it at all, whether that slide would be very different, perhaps, in that case. So Yes, of the people in the 2005 cohort, we did ask them slightly different questions. We asked them this way one, and I think there was a similar sort of patterning to that. But there was within the 2006 cohort, there was also a group of people who did not go on to university in the end, because we started collecting data in the summer of 2006, and that actually gives us a better impression of this whole issue. You probably know far more about this than me. There's a lot of admissions people here, isn't there? But basically, of the people who applied in any single year, that there's kind of 100,000 people who don't actually go, and it's not always because they failed to get the grades. Sometimes they chose not to go. And of the ones who chose not to go, quite a number of them do cite financial concerns. Yeah. So that's the closest we get to trying to capture people who didn't go. We've got several thousand of those in the study as well. And we're trying to maintain contact with them. I think we have maintained contact with some of them, but nothing like the numbers that are in HE. But it's an interesting area to explore. And as far as I know, the study is unprecedented. There isn't anything else quite like this. As far as I know, unless anybody knows of any studies like this, please do tell us. But we understand it's pretty much unique. Working, of course, by stage two, working was very much something that we were interested in finding more out about. And there are differences in actually who works. And I don't know, is anybody Scottish here? You're a very work hard lot, if you are. Nobody Scottish here? No, not one. Yeah, absolutely. More Scots are working than anybody else, and also expected to, which is interesting, isn't it? Within the part-time study, then basically, sorry, this is another full-time study one, you're more likely to work if you're doing something like a higher national or a diploma in HE, and I think also the foundation degree students, of whom there are also a small proportion of full-time foundation degree students in the study, they're more likely to work. And again, you can think that, well, there's an obvious relationship for this, isn't there, because perhaps they are people who are supported. And also, those aged 21 to 25 are more likely to work longer hours, in this case over 16 hours. And again, you might assume that people who are in that age group perhaps had jobs before they applied to university in the first place. Medics are claimed to work the least number of hours, although, you know, relatives of mine in who tell me this is just nonsense because they're working very hard as part of their course and they actually don't have time to do any other kind of job. But that might be a discussion to have at some other time. The average amount of time that full-timers was working was around 9 hours a week. But actually, quite substantial numbers of people were working for more than 16 hours a week. And this, again, was also differentiated by different groups and different subjects and so on. Is this more or less than you would have thought? Would you have thought more, maybe, about what you'd expect? Perhaps a bit less? I mean, it's a national sort of statistic, and it takes into account some universities actively discourage working during term times and others don't. And there are huge differences in terms of institutional type on work, the amount of working. But when I showed this once to a group of people from sixth formers, they said, well, yeah, sixth formers are working easily this much too, so not that surprising, really. The reasons why they worked, I think, as you know, career development professionals, we were hoping to hear things like, it'll give me work experience, it'll give me skills, generic skills, transferable skills, knowledge of my future employment opportunities. No, that wasn't it. No, they were mainly working in order to pay for essential costs, which included, as a very high proportion of people were claiming, in order to avoid debt, in order to pay for study materials. Yes, to pay for holidays and leisure activities too, but certainly serious matters like managing to survive the HE experience. Of course, part-time students, as we mentioned earlier, are generally working. Not always. We mustn't forget that there are many that that don't have jobs, but lots of them are working. And in our survey, quite a lot of them, most of them were working full-time, but quite a lot of them were also working part-time. And of those who were in employment, we asked them more and different sorts of questions about employer support, and we found that, again, perhaps this won't surprise you, the employers are much more likely to give support, either full-time support or part-fee support, to people on higher nationals, twice as much as on a degree programme. And also, we find that people on higher nationals are much more likely to get time off to study than people who are on foundation degrees or first degrees. Does that surprise you, or maybe not? Do you think people actively choose to do part-time study because of these sorts of things? Do you think this is the reason why people choose to study part-time rather than full-time? The economic drivers are behind those kinds of decisions are very strong too, aren't they? I think lots of people, I suspect, don't actually get to the stage that they think, shall I go full or part-time? Lots of people almost discount full-time because they want to stay in work. And what seems to have come out of our study is the idea that basically you either want to go into education full-time and put up with loans and uncertainty of job and so on and so forth, and sometimes for more mature students, as your partner perhaps, giving up a job in order to go into full-time education. For people in part-time education, the motivation that they're telling us about is that it's more to do with flexibility, and it's more to do with actually being able to weave the study around all their other commitments. So we seem to have people who are talking about their responsibilities, their domestic responsibilities, and the need for maintaining their income and so on. And so the motivation, the basis of the motivation is different, I think. And so, again, perhaps, you know, maybe this wouldn't be so surprising, but the extent of employer support, though, certainly within our study, is very considerable. There is a separate report if you want to look at that, which again might be interesting, particularly if, as I think it was Professor Gillies was saying early, why are we worried about full and part time? Is it, you know, is it perhaps time now that we should begin to challenge that whole notion of full and part time study when so many full time students are working and so many part time students are also working very similar amounts of time? But of course the basis of the decision making appears to be very different, but also the funding arrangement is hugely different, as you know. I wonder why it could be a function of our sample, because the sample, we decided not to try to capture a representative sample of all part-timers. We've chosen particular subjects, and two of the subjects are engineering and technologies, and you find a lot of HNDs are still being offered in those subject disciplines. Foundation degrees, I think, are broader as a subject. I mean, for example, we didn't include nurses in this because there have been lots of studies of part-time nurses, and we didn't want to add to that, really. But yeah, it is surprising. I thought there would be more of a par. I'm not surprised about the lack of support for BAs and BSCs somehow. Just looking at the time, need to gallop along a bit here. One of the things that we felt, does the institution matter? Yes, it does. When we first started FutureTrack, one of the things that we found ourselves doing quite a lot of was looking at the findings in terms of the broad mission groups and finding information that supported the idea that it was more or less easy to get into Russell groups than pre and post 92 and so on. And there is some interesting data in the Stage 1 report about that. But by Stage 2, the research team were beginning to play around with this a little bit, because the single most defining characteristic of whether one gets into any HE place is whether or not the UCAS points are there. And so they developed a classification of HEIs based on tariff points, and they were using highest... high, medium, low, and lower tariff points as a sort of proxy for difficulty of getting into HEIs. Yeah. But if you're classifying the HEI, the HEIs typically fish from certain pools. And this, the tariff points are attaching to the mainly to the HEIs, but yes. I suspect because of where our sample is drawn, we've actually got quite a small proportion of people coming through FutureTrack who were in access courses. Actually, most people have do have tariff points of some kind or other to offer. But it does matter, I would suggest to you, because the information changes. Perhaps if I just show you a couple of things. For example, those at HE colleges were less likely to work. And those with a clear idea of working. I'm not sure whether that slide's in quite the right place here. Basically, those with a clear idea of what they were going to do were more likely to be working for 16 hours. I think I've put that slide in the wrong place. I do apologise. Can I just move on? That's it. That's better. The ones who were basically more likely to be working longer hours were the ones in general HE colleges and also in lower tariff universities. If anyone's interested in seeing a paper on how this classification system was developed, I can certainly send you one, and also which universities fall into which band. As you might probably expect, there are a lot of Russell Group institutions in the highest tariff banding, but not all of them, actually. There are a lot of post-92s in the lower and the medium tariff bands, but again, not always. You know, it's not as clear-cut as that. But this was really quite striking, it seemed to us, that people basically are working fewer hours. And I know there's a mixed message here about working, whilst there are studies around that demonstrate that having work experience, having a job, actually enhances your capacity to do well in your studies. There is also research around that suggests that working too much can cost you a grade in your final classification. So the whole matter of how many hours people are working does seem to be founded in an analysis of which institutional type they're at. But more than that, this particular thing, I think, perhaps illustrates this a little bit more sharply. If we actually look at HEI access by age group in this case, I hope this is visible at the back again, you're more likely to be in a Russell Group or in the highest tariff institution if you're 18 and under at the point of application than any of the other age groups. I mean, I think you'd probably expect that, wouldn't you? But when you actually look at the new tariff system, which is the top bands there, the age differences change quite dramatically on general HE and specialist HE, which in the previous way of looking at it by mission group, they would have just been lumped together as other HE. Does that make sense? So, again, the new classification system has allowed for a little bit more granularity in terms of looking at of what's actually happening. This slide might be a little clearer at the back, I think. This is a statement question where we ask them to agree whether the opportunities for extracurricular work were available to them. And, again, there's a very strong relationship between the highest tariff point universities and also the Russell Group. But looking down the list again, there's quite dramatic difference between agreement with that if you're in an other HEI or if you're in a general HE or a specialist HE. And of course, opportunities for extracurricular activities are the kinds of things that people use to put on their CVs, to land jobs, and also the enhancement, the enriching activities that some universities do appear to be making more available, or students are accessing more. I'd be interested to know whether you think it is because the universities make them more available or whether it's because students are more likely to access them. But, you know, the difference there is nearly halved, isn't it, in terms of I actually identifying that within general HE institutions, students are significantly less likely to agree that they have access to extracurricular activities. This making sense? Yeah. We will probably have some information on that once we look at the Stage 3 findings, which are actually going to be launched fairly soon. And there's some very interesting stuff coming through in the Stage 3 findings too. But certainly we're now beginning to play around with moving away from mission groups and trying to find other ways of classifying HEIs. Okay. Just to finish, I don't know if there's anything anyone wants to ask about here so far. Any questions?
Just one. I mean, when you did the quite a way back the slides, you had state schools, but what I'm particularly interested in further education in sixth form colleges, because I think on the HE advice, yeah. I think you ought to get a significantly different picture there, I would have thought.
Yeah, we did.
But I just wondered within what you've got, can you do that breakdown?
Yeah.
So you've got information on sixth forms and sixth colleges and FE colleges.
Yes, we can. It's not on that slide, but yes, we can. And again, there's some interesting stuff about FE colleges from what I can recall. I haven't got the report with me, so I can't give you sort of actual numbers here. But there did seem to be more of an appetite for information, advice and guidance coming through from FE students, and more of an interest in A, having it, and B, judging whether or not it was effective, which was very, very interesting. And again, I think that also tied in with age. If you have a look at the Stage 1 report, you'll find that there's a chapter on getting information before you apply that actually does actually say quite interesting things about different institutional types at pre-HE stage. Are there any other questions at this stage?
You said right at the beginning that it was a very interesting time to do it because of the changing economic situation and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Were you able to in any way screen that out or filter it out of the students' changing responses to their career plans and all that sort of thing or not? Because were there any significant changes in perhaps people's confidence in the economic situation during the study?
I think we'll be able to answer that question better when we have the whole of the Stage 3 survey reported upon. But yes, there does seem to be already information that's coming through. I mean, basically the research team have done half of the report. They haven't done it all, so I'm not really supposed to tell you what findings from Stage 3 are yet, because we like to check things very carefully before we say anything. But there does seem to be some growing awareness that the economic climate has changed dramatically and, you know, taken the rug from under them, a lot of them. We've got information that suggests that, for example, people are talking about taking not the job that they really would have liked, but any sort of job in order to make sure that they get a foothold in the labour market. There's information coming through that suggests people are thinking, can I really afford to do postgrad study? And equally, there's information from other students saying, yes, I'm more likely now to do a postgrad study as a way of hedging against the recession. I think it's the Stage 3 report's going to have quite a lot of quite tangible data, I think, about how people are coping with the recessionary times. Yeah. And of course, we'll see it in the Delhi data as well, won't we?
Does the Stage 3 data disaggregate some of the data that you have here into wider participation groups, such as Cohort 2 categories or anything like that?
Yeah, it can do, yes. What we tend to do with FutureTrack is that at the end of each stage, we produce a big report. The reports for Stage 1 and Stage 2 are already available on the HECSU website if you want to have a look at them. But Stage 3, as I say, hasn't actually been finished yet. what goes into a report is largely what the research team think is the most interesting material. But because the data sets are so huge, it's possible if people have a particular query to go back in and have another look at something. So if there's anything that an individual institution or a particular organisation is interested in having a look at, we go back and have another look. So, for example, with
focus on this project in
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there is in both of stage one and two quite a commentary about social equity and equality issues and how diverse it is, but also how patterned it is in ways that, you know, perhaps are a bit disappointing, really. But certainly in stage three, there will be a chapter on those kinds of issues. But what we haven't done is to do a whole report on widening participation on its own yet. But it could be done. It's been a chapter in the reports only so far.
Are you linking with Action on Access or
FC? Sorry?
Hefke
is certainly very involved in what we do. There's a steering group behind Future Track, and Hefke have been very supportive all the way through. And we do various bits of work jointly with Hefke, and he's looking at data generally as an organisation. But we haven't been involved in the widening access. No, not expressly. No, maybe we should be. But for example, we are doing some work with Future Track data for Foundation Degree Forward, looking at the Foundation Degree students. So they have not appeared particularly visibly in the reports that are online so far. But as I say, it's a huge data set, and the intention is ultimately to put it into the data archive so that other researchers can get hold of it and use it. Suitably anonymised, I do say. I mean, there'll be no identifying information in here that would reveal any one respondent. I have to say that, otherwise Kate Purcell and co would lynch me. But yeah.
One question. What I'm interested in, I suppose, is probably going to be in stage three, but...
yeah, everybody's interested in stage three.
Can you track by entry qualification?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So it would be possible to see whether and degree achievement, I presume.
Mm. We can certainly do entry information, yes, but degree achievement, we have to rely on the students telling us what they got, because you probably know as much about this as I do, the linking the beginning and the end. We haven't tried to merge it with student record. We can't do that yet. I mean, we would be able to tell out of the people who responded to Future Track which of them were likely to be access people. Yes, that would be possible. And one of the things that we've tried very hard to do, but it's been very, very hard, is to try to hang on to the people who are in the first cohort and track them through. And as you probably know, with surveys, lots of people will do the first one, less people will do the second one, even less will do the third one, and we're just keeping our fingers crossed that there's a respectable number of folks still hanging on in there for the fourth one. And so whilst that affects the way in which we can report the findings and the granularity of the findings, what it also does is to cause you problems with things like access groups, you know, because they probably were small at the very beginning. And so... yeah, that's the problem. But yeah, but it would be interesting to have a look at it, certainly, and you know, let's have a talk about it perhaps separately if you're interested in doing any work in this area, because it is a big data set. I mean, we had about 130,000 at stage one, but by stage two that had halved, and we're now looking at about 25,000. So it's still big in terms of lots of people, but, you know, the number of access people at that stage. And there's a core of people, I think it's between 40 and 50,000, who've responded to stages 1, 2 and 3. And that's the really interesting stuff, actually. That's really what we want. And if we could hang on to that into the labour market, we'd really be saying some interesting things, I think.
UK-wide, does it include
Wales Island?
You mentioned
Scotland. It does, yeah. It's UK-wide, yeah. Yep, they're all on the steering group too, yes. Yeah. Dell always turns up. FQ doesn't always, but yeah. But yeah, we've got representatives from all of those organisations. And one of the things that we would like to do, this study has been funded by HECSU only at the moment. The part-time study has also been partly funded with some BIS money, but basically it's been funded only by HECSU. And we would, you know, dearly like to have some more resources if we could attract them from any of the government agencies, or to continue this study and to amplify it, because I think the findings are really quite significant. I'm very conscious of the time. If anyone wants to get in touch with me about anything they felt they haven't had a chance to ask about, please do so. My email is on the end of this PowerPoint. But if we've got a few minutes and you don't mind the indulgence, another study that we did last year, HECSU this time, Graduate Prospects rather than Future Track, one of the things that we're concerned about is league tables of employers. I guess you might be too. Some league tables actually ask students what they think of companies, and we were really interested in trying to develop a survey which would ask employees, new graduate employees, what they think of their companies. And last year, for the first time, we set up a new study called Real Prospects, which I don't expect anybody's here heard of, because Future Track's been around for some years. Real Prospects is very new. And it's, again, another turned out to be another big one. Last year we had about 24,000 respondents, and this year we've had, again, sizable numbers of respondents. And these are the views of new and recent graduates of their employers. And it's a sort of satisfaction survey. You know, how did they recruit you? How satisfied are you with your induction and your training and your prospects and so on? And I thought we might end with some comments from participants in the Real Prospect Survey, because these are real live graduates. All of them graduated within the last 5 years, and they're talking to you now, if you want to hear it, don't you? About their experiences starting work. Yep, we've got time for a few minutes. I know we're supposed to finish now, but yep, do you want to have a look? Okay.
I think when I applied for a lot of different grad schemes, the NHS stood out quite a mile from the other grad schemes, because there's so many different areas that it doesn't limit you to what you can do.
They have a dedicated training centre which is away from the city. I think that was really important and very different from the other employers, and it just shows how dedicated they are to training and how important they think it is. So if they think it's important, then surely they will help you achieve what you want to achieve.
I made sure that I looked around lots of different companies. I went to career fairs at the university and took the opportunity whilst I was there not just to grab a leaflet, but to actually talk to the people. I think because I had a family member in the NHS, the opinion that I got was slightly varied, and I got every day a lot of criticisms and things like that, and I thought, oh, I could probably change that, I could probably make things better. No, the negatives didn't scare me off. I quite like a challenge, and I thought that was the way to go. And also at the moment, which is quite fitting, is the security of working for the public sector.
People more than ever before overall career. They're looking more for a job. They're looking in the here and now rather than what they're going to be doing in 20 years' time, I think. And also they want to work 9 to 5. They want a lot of time to themselves. So I guess from that point of view, it is less around money. And it's especially in today's sort of climate, I guess, economic climate, it's more around having a job, firstly, and a bit of security there, and also a job that you enjoy.
Obviously, like most graduates, the salary and the benefits package is quite important.
Salary does play a part, but also things like work-life balance.
Some people will be more in tune to decide on a company they work for based on the financial reward or the sort of reputation that goes with joining a company. I wanted to join a business that had a strong corporate social and ethical responsibility.
Okay, so that was just a little glimpse really of some of the views, and certainly what we're hoping we'll be able to do with Future Track is to actually follow our cohort of students right through to that stage when they're beginning work, and who knows, some of our Future Trackers might end up in Real Prospects, which would be really completing the circle for me, and hopefully it would give us some really interesting data. But thank you all very much indeed for listening, and if you've got any other questions, I'd be more than delighted to answer them either here today, or do email me if you want any more information. So thank you very much indeed.